We've done over $2 billion of transactions, spanning over hundreds of transactions.
Every contractor dreams of growing a successful business, but very few build one that's actually worth buying.
Entrepreneurs and operators out there in the market, they are so hyper-focused on income. How do we create more income? Income, income, income.
Where he teaches entrepreneurs how to build, scale, and eventually sell their companies for maximum value.
If you are that key person in your business and you are intending to sell your company, that investors are going to perceive that as a risk.
Dive into what private equity really looks for when buying a contracting business.
Not everyone understands the value of their asset.
This is AI and Marketing for Home Service Pros, the show for contractors who want to grow without wasting time or money. If you're in roofing, HVAC, plumbing, or any home service business, we break down how AI and modern marketing can help you book more jobs, close more leads, and build a business that runs without babysitting every task.
Every contractor dreams of growing a successful business, but very few build one that's actually worth buying. My guest today is Brian Franco, Managing Partner at Meritage Partners, M&A advisory firm that's completed over $2 billion in transactions across multiple industries. He's also the author of the new book, The Inevitable Exit, where he teaches entrepreneurs how to build, scale, and eventually sell their companies for maximum value. In this conversation, Brian and I dive into what private equity really looks for when buying a contracting business, why two companies with the same profit can sell for wildly different multiples, and how to create predictable revenue that investors love. We talk about the seven value drivers that determine your multiplier, the biggest deal killers he sees during due diligence, and how smart owners are using marketing data, things like CAC and LTV, to raise your valuations. We also get into the future of M&A and AI, how automation, analytics, and even AI evaluation tools are already changing the way deals get done. Whether you want to sell your business one day, pass it down to your kids, or just make it more efficient and profitable, this episode is a masterclass on how to build a company that's not just successful, but sellable. All right, guys, this is Mauricio Cardinal. I'm with the AI Marketing and Home Services show. Super excited to have Brian Franco. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thanks for having me. Super honored and excited to be here to speak with you in the audience. So, you know, I love the way you approach these podcasts, just unscripted conversation. So I'm ready. Let's go.
Yeah. So let's get right into it. You know, Brian, you've been in private equity and M&A for over 23 years now and have worked over $2 billion in sales, right? Can you share how you got into this world and what drew you helping business owners exit successfully?
Gosh, I'll give you the shortest version I possibly can. But, you know, my life really took a big turn at age 16. When I became a single father of my first son, Jacob, who is actually in the studio with me here today. He's been working with our firm since he was 16. He wanted to intern it when he was in high school. So I'm like, come on over, let's go. I'll put you on the phone. So, you know, that experience that slingshotted me into manhood, you know, and I became an entrepreneur at 17 and a half. I worked, I was in partnership with my father and his company, and went to school, learned everything that I can. I was studying accounting, I was studying law, and I started working in lending, commercial lending, and financing business acquisitions. And that quickly led to clients saying, hey, like, you get it. Can you help us now, you know, sell this company? Sure. And so that, you know, was the evolution of my work. I was 26 years old when I finally founded Meritage Partners. And I say finally, I mean, 26, I was a kid. But over the last 20 years in the firm and 23 years in this industry, we've done over $2 billion of transactions, spanning over hundreds of transactions. 21 of our clients we sold to publicly traded buyers. And the balance thereof were sold to strategic buyers that were either financial, private equity, independent sponsors, family offices, or even other larger privately held strategic buyers in their respective industries. And I learned a lot, and that's the headline, right? The headline is, wow, these guys have done $2 billion of exits. Amazing. But the real learning, I think, and the real value of working with our firm, and it was really distilled down into my recently released book called The Inevitable Exit. And in this book, I distill down 7 value drivers of every company that needs to be concerned with, because as most entrepreneurs and operators out there in the market, especially home services, they are so hyper-focused on income. How do we create more income? Income, income, income. And that's not wrong. That's not wrong at all. But what there's a piece of this, and there's another dimension of this that needs to be considered, and that's the outcome. And the outcome of what's possible with the asset that you're building within your business. You know, we've had some clients at some stages in working with us saying, well, Brian, who's going to be interested in buying our company? And then once they see the offers, they say, wow. And the volume of offers on their business, they say, we never knew, right? And so, what that meant, and you can still hear me okay, right? All right, perfect. I saw a call coming in, and I just didn't know if it cut me off. But what we've learned though is that not everyone understands the value of their asset. And so a lot of companies out there are investors specifically are chasing home service businesses. And so some of you listening to this podcast here might say, well, yeah, I get those calls every week, or I get those calls every day. And the reality is, some of those calls are from actual investors. Some of those calls are going to be from marketing companies positioning themselves as an investor to really just produce a lead, which they intend to sell. And it's really hard to differentiate, because we get the same calls. Back when there was fax machines, we used to get these faxes and it says, hey, do you want to sell your company? Call us now. And but those are marketing companies. We do not work with those types of marketing companies because we want to curate the relationship with our clients and we want to meet them where they are. And so some of those, you know, have not received an offer or have not received any interest. Some have. But the reality is, even if whether they have or they have not, what is still not understood at this point by most of our clients is, what is the valuation of their company and how do investors perceive that value? And because, you know, a common theme, and I'm sure you heard the phrase EBITDA, the acronym EBITDA, which is earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. So the common knowledge is like, oh, if I get my EBITDA up, my valuation will go up. Well, they're halfway right. Because to determine a valuation of your company, investors are going to look at it. Yes, they're going to look at your EBITDA. They're going to take that number and they're going to multiply it by some sort of factor. That could be 4 times, 4.5 times, 5 times, 6 times, 8 times, 10 times. And so the question then becomes, or the question that you should be asking is, well, why am I getting a 4.5 times my EBITDA offer? And my buddy, you know, down the road, he just sold his company for 8 times. What's the difference, right? And so what we really do is we spend a lot of time educating our clients up front on how to impact, yes, EBITDA, that's your income aspect, but how do you impact the multiplier? How do you increase that multiplier? And the most quickest form and version of this that I could share with you is that it comes down to the investor's perception of your company. Do they perceive a business that has high levels of risk, or do they perceive a business that has predictable revenue streams, continuity, and the ability to be transitioned at some point in some stage with a larger growing company? And so if you can position the company to have a low perception of risk, an actual risk, those are found in the 7 value drivers that I talk about in the inevitable exit. And that is what increases your multiplier. That is your differentiator in the market. And that's why one company may receive an offer at 4.5 times EBITDA versus the next company receiving 8 times EBITDA. And it has to do with those 7 factors that we distill down in the book. So it's a very nuanced conversation. There's a lot of more to unpack there, but I'm trying to keep it in its most basic, you know, simple form so that everyone can understand it. Because that's how I like to be spoken to as well, right? When I go to my doctor, I'm like, okay, doc, Even sometimes I'll like put into ChatGPT, like, explain this to me like I'm a 20-year-old kid. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You say every owner will exit either by design or by default. Why do you think so many owners don't plan for that?
They don't, no one's telling them to plan. And I really, you know, what do I blame? I blame all of those templates online, all those business plan templates that are online, because none of them have an exit plan built into that template. And they should, right? Because that's part of your business plan. You got to know how you're going to get in, how you're going to make money, but you also have to understand, okay, how do you get out? And getting out doesn't necessarily mean a fire sale, doesn't mean you're in bad health. It could, right? But you know, there's all sorts of circumstance from, you know, death, divorce, burnout. But there's also the other side of the equation where companies hit this glass ceiling and they just can't seem to break $20 million or $40 million of revenue. And there's a reason, because to take your company from 0 to $20 million of revenue and everything in between takes a specific mindset and a specific discipline. But to take it from, let's say, you know, that $40 million mark to 100 million to 150 million to $250 million in revenues, it requires a different set of thinking. And so those that, you know, when they say, so they see the title Inevitable Exit, it's very telling that, look, we're all going to exit. I'm going to exit my firm one day, right? The big question is for everyone is, are you going to exit on your terms or are you going to exit on somebody else's terms?
Yeah, exactly. And then with somebody, I actually thought about this before when I started the company. I've always wanted to build a business in that manner, right? Even, I have no intention of selling it right now.
That's right. That's right.
But like, what do you tell owners what they should do to change how they operate on a day-to-day for that exit, even if they have no planning on selling?
Well, you should be operating from that yacht that's cruising behind you right now, for starters, right? I mean, that's one way to do it. I mean, this guy's cruising on a Friday afternoon, not a worry in the world, right? Like, that's beautiful. I love that. But yeah, I mean, I think when you think about so those that would potentially, you know, state that, look, I'm never going to exit my company. Okay. And I say, okay, explain that to me. And they say, well, I'm going to pass the business down to my kids. Okay. That's an exit. Or they say, no, I'm never selling the company. I'm going to pass it down to my leadership team. Like, okay, that's an exit. And so, you know, all roads lead to that inevitable exit. It's just, you know, how are you going to structure that? How are you going to architect that? And so, you know, there's ways to do this. I mean, there's even, I don't know if you heard the phrase ESOP. It's Employee Stock Ownership Program. And this is a program in which an owner or owners of a company can sell all or part of the business back to the employees, right? That's also an exit. So whether you're transition, the real question is, are you going to transition or exit the business internally or externally? Those are the two paths, right? And regardless of whatever path that is, what are you leaving behind, right, to the next generation of leadership, the next generation of ownership of that business? Because the problems that you have not solved in the business, or the troubles that you have ongoing with the business, are not going to magically disappear when you exit it, right? And that becomes more of a topic and a concern if you're exiting a business, you're receiving, let's say, majority cash at close, but let's say you have some sort of seller note or you're offered some level of equity or a contingent payment. That's all dependent not on what the business has done until today. Let's say today was the closing day. All of those factors and terms depend upon what the business will do in the future. For those areas in your business, let's call them, you know, points of friction in your business that you have not solved or resolved, are going to be continuous, right? Now, through certain mergers and acquisition deals, you can solve or neutralize some of these concerns. That's definitely part of the equation here in the plan. But if you're transferring the business internally, like if I were going to transfer my business to my son Jacob, who's sitting here with me, it's like, well, what haven't I corrected in the business And what is he going to have to solve for? I don't want him to have to solve for anything that I'm aware of. And of course, there's going to be, you know, evolutions of the industry and regulation and changes in the future to be dealt with. But if you can focus on that inevitable exit, the natural progression of the work and the roadmap that we're giving readers and our clients is they're going to build a highly transferable business that's going to attract very high grade and high quality investors. And we're going to enable those investors to pay the highest valuation. And I'm not saying overpay. I'm saying they're going to pay the highest valuation on that business because they want to own that asset. They want to own everything that you've embedded in that business, from SOPs to culture to branding and so on and so on and so forth, especially speaking to the work that you do, right, from a branding perspective. So that's what it comes down to. Are you going to exit internally or externally? You need to decide, but regardless, you're inevitably going to exit that company.
Exactly. You've seen hundreds of deals. What are the biggest mistakes that kill deals or destroy value during due diligence?
So I'm going to give you guys a free gift. I'm going to talk about it, but if you go to inevitableexit.com, we do have a free gift for you, and it's the 10 deal killers that we see in M&A transactions. So I'll give you an example of a couple of them, because we could go on for probably a half hour on this topic alone, right? But, you know, do you have key employees in the organization? And if you do, you know, are they staying with you long term? And what's that relationship and what's that contract look like? If you are that key person in your business and you are intending to sell your company, I will tell you that investors are going to perceive that as a risk if you leave the day after you sell the business. And they have to solve for that risk. And they typically solve for that risk by offering you a lower valuation and less favorable deal terms, right? So if you are worked yourself out of a job, is what I'll say, right? And that's exactly what you need to do to not be considered a key person in the organization. But if you could work out yourself out of a job and really sit in a position of authority in your company as a leader, then at that point, it's interchangeable who owns that company. To investors, it's an asset. It doesn't matter which investor owns that asset. What matters is, can that asset be transferred? And so in those 10 deal killers that we will share with you, that's one very important one to consider. I'll tease you with another one, you know, and if you could have revenue concentration. So revenue concentration could come in a couple forms. You have a tremendous amount of your revenue, you know, over 25% of your revenues with one customer. That's a revenue concentration risk. Or if you are in home services, just like healthcare, home service and healthcare companies are paid by who? On the re-roofing side, for example, they're paid by insurance companies, right? And so if you have certain concentration with the payer, you know, you have to be mindful of what that relationship looks like with that. Are they friendly with you? Are they working with you? Are they always working against you on every project that you're working on, right? Because that could be perceived as a risk. I'm not saying it's an actual risk, but it could be perceived as a risk. And so it just needs to be understood how those relationships, whether it's an actual customer or whether that's an insurance payer. And as you and I both know, in the home services space, insurance companies are getting more and more wiser about how do they handle claims, and more specifically, how do they not have to pay out so much for these expensive claims that they're handling on a daily basis.
Yeah, exactly. You made a great distinction. Contractors know how to sell their trade, but not how to trade their business. What's the difference?
Yeah. Well, selling the trade is exactly as you would expect, right? If you're relying on, you know, door-to-door sales reps as an example, or if it's internet marketing, you know, how do you get people to call you? And then once they call you, how good are you at selling your trade? And there's a lot of courses out there, a lot of good coaches and advisors that teach companies on how to be better sale are selling their trades. But to sell the company, right? And that's my trade is selling companies. When you think about the differentiator, it's not all that different, right? Because what we're doing is we're simply just articulating the messaging of your business. And we're doing that in a marketing document called a confidential information memorandum, or sometimes known as a pitch book. And so in this pitch book that we go to market with, we're talking about the business past, present, and future. We're talking about the organizational chart. We're talking about the financials, past, present, and future. And we're really helping them understand what's your differentiation in the market? How are you able to serve your customers and clients? And more importantly, how can that be scaled in other geographic regions across the country? Because that's what investors are looking for. They're looking not just to buy a business, to own it and keep it, you know, steady Eddie, so to speak. They want to acquire that company. They want to inject additional capital, and they want to 10X that company over time. And a really good case study of a transaction in the home services space that we concluded back in February of this year. And I talked about this on one of my podcast episodes. We sold this business to a larger strategic buyer. He was in roofing and siding. And, you know, during the due diligence process and the negotiation of that deal, the investor said to my client, "Hey, what do you need to grow?" He says, "Well, I need three things. It's pretty simple." "Okay, what are those three things?" "Well, I need more tablets, more sales reps, and more trucks." And so the investor listened and they delivered. The week after we closed, they delivered double the sales reps, double the iPads, and double the trucks, all at his doorstep, like legitimately at his doorstep. Trucks were wrapped, ready to go. Everything was dialed in. And so he, primarily in re-roofing, was in an area that was hit by two major hailstorms. And within the first, I think it was within the first 4 weeks is when the first hailstorm hit. And then another one. He is now on the roadmap by the end of this year, 2025. Remember, we just closed this deal transaction in February. So call it 9.5 months in, or not by the time this year is over, in 9.5 months time frame, he has 4X'd his revenue with his new private equity investor.
I'm curious, how did that private equity company recruit, how many salespeople did it hire in that 1 week?
Yeah, he doubled the force. I think they brought on, they went from 12 to 24. And this is the beauty of some of these larger strategic buyers is that, you know, they have dedicated people that are only recruiting sales reps, right? They have dedicated people that's only handling legal issues. They have dedicated people that's only working on financial functions of a company, so that you, as an operator of a local regional business, or maybe you're a multi-state operator, but you can take that model, and with that sort of horsepower behind you, you as an operator could go so much further, because you're not just selling your company or exiting your company. Because remember, a lot of our clients, they will maintain or retain an equity piece of the business going forward, because they too also want that upside. And so when we position the transactions in that way, we call them apple bites, right? So you have multiple bites of the apple. The first bite of the apple is that, you know, first, let's say it's you receive 80% of your company's value in cash on the closing table on closing day. And 20% of the transaction, you maintain an equity in the form of equity with the larger strategic buyer. So everyone's equally yoked, right? They say all ships rise with the tide. So when everyone wins, everyone wins. But when you spend time with owners and operators, and I think this will resonate with you as well, is you think about where are you most impactful in your business, right? And a lot of us would say, well, at least in the beginning stages of our businesses, we would say we were most impactful at selling. We were earning new clients, earning new business, however you want to describe that. And then life catches up, right? You have more employees, you have more payroll, you have more accidents, you have more in issues with accounts receivable, and your time gets divided amongst all of these roles and responsibilities. But it's taking you away from the role that was the very reason you were successful at early stage. And that is your ability to grow the revenue of the business. And that's, you know, through relationships, through networking, through communication, so on and so forth. So I see that, yes, you know, it's an exit, as everyone describes it to be, but I see it, if you're young enough, and if you're, you know, for example, we do have clients that are in their 60s and 70s, and they want to exit their company so they could go and retire and cruise the harbor like those boats we saw just a moment ago. But we have a lot of clients that they're in their 30s and 40s and 50s, and they have, you know, 2 to 15 more years to keep going, right? Most of them 2 to 7, just to be fair. But if they can collapse time in that 2 to 7 years, and if they can grow at a rate of 130% a year, which is the average growth rate of a company after it's entered into an M&A transaction, then they could get to their intended destination much faster with less heartache, less headache, less brain damage, and more importantly, more capital that's not just coming out of their pocket.
A lot of priority has gone into the home services space, roofing, HVAC, plumbing, I mean, for years now. What are investors actually looking for in these businesses?
So we've been servicing home service companies since 2008. And so what happened in 2008, if those that are listening were in business at that time, new construction was explosive, right? Commercial, residential, industrial, just absolutely explosive. 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006. And then halfway through 07, everything just kind of stopped. And then we hit the Great Recession. And so contractors were out of work. New projects were not being built at the levels that they were historically because money stopped moving. And so what we saw at that time is a lot of those contractors went into water and fire damage restoration. And so you had all of these segmented water and fire damage restoration companies situated across the country, servicing homes and servicing businesses that have suffered from water or fire damage. And so what investors were looking for at that time, it's no different to here in 2025, but what they were looking for at that time was they were looking to take a segmented industry, consolidate that industry, and to create a national organization that's servicing residential homeowners to building owners, insurance companies, and everyone that's involved, as you could imagine, in an insurance claim, whether it's water or fire damage. So let me ask you, how many reputable national water and fire damage restoration companies are there in the U.S. today?
I'm not really in that industry a lot, but I wouldn't say that much, right?
It's about a half a dozen, right? So it went from thousands to a half a dozen national players, and they just dominate the market, right? And so now continue on this journey and continue on this path. So investors saw the success in water and fire damage restoration. And then they saw it in HVAC. And then they saw it in plumbing. And then they saw it also in roofing, in windows, in siding, in doors. And let's not forget solar, right? Solar was a little bit different because that was primarily retail. But all that to say, that evolution of these types of companies is really themed in the same way. Investors were looking to take a segmented industry and consolidate it.
Yeah, and it's very common in other industries, right? If you look at the typical industry, they're dominated by two or three big players, right? But these fragmented industries are like the home services space. They have, now they're starting to have like more national players, but they have literally like hundreds of thousands of businesses in these spaces, right? And they're more regional, right? They're not national, but that's not typical. Most businesses have, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 big players, right? So this is something that's an opportunity, right? I think that these investors are taking advantage of, right? Which is, you know, there's a pros and cons to everything, right? You said, you know, investors love predictable revenue streams, and that's kind of the main reason, you know, they see the risk with investing in businesses, right? What makes a contracting business, a home service business, predictable and what scares investors away?
So if you're in retail, you know, predictability of revenue is really going to be dependent, you know, upon multiple factors. The economy could be one of those. In insurance paid work, the factor is going to be, you know, what are the reimbursement rates in your area for a certain project? Right, regardless of what type of damage was done, it's just, you know, what is the insurance company going to pay? And so when it comes to damage from a storm or water damage, fire damage, whatever it may be, storms are not predictable at all. But we know they're coming, we just don't know when they're coming. And so really, when you think about, okay, how can you take a home services contractor and how do you generate predictable revenue streams? Well, when you think about, okay, industries where there's the highest level of predictable nature of revenue. Well, let's think about it. Insurance, yes. We all have to pay it, you know. So insurance is one. There's health, there's auto, there's you know, life insurance. There's all sorts of options. But what else? What else is a good industry that has predictable revenue? Well, software. Like, you know, you and I are sitting right now on a platform called Riverside FM, which, you know, we use and you use, and we pay a monthly subscription for that service, right? So Riverside FM has predictable revenue every month, whether we pay it or not, because it's automatically drawn, right, from our credit card statements. That fee is being paid every single month, 12 months a year. So that's predictable. That's a predictable revenue stream. So how do you take the likings of these companies in those industries, and how do you put that into a company that's in the home services space? Well, the answer, it's not all that complicated, because although, you know, you can't predict that these houses on these streets are going to get hit with a storm every Tuesday of the third full moon of every year, right? It's not that, we're not predicting it in that way. The way we're predicting it is really comes down to how are you positioning your business in your markets? If it's retail, what does your SEO strategy look like? If it's retail, how are you reaching more and more homeowners so that they're coming back to you and asking you for a quote? If it's insurance, how are you deploying your representatives, your sales reps, to a region of the country that was hit by a storm? And how you converting that work into projects or into contracts within your organization. And so, again, all of those elements that we don't have control over, like the economy and storms, what we do have control over is you are building a machine. You're building a marketing machine with sales reps, with systems, with ad spend, and so on and so forth. And that machine becomes very predictable. Why? Because if you stick a dollar in the entry point of that machine and $18 comes out the other end every single time, whether, you know, and again, storms are not predictable, economy is not predictable. But if you've built a machine that's creating steady lead flow, which, and you have a way to convert that leads to contracts, that becomes the measurable predictable piece of your business.
I've heard this from different people. I want to get your take on this. Is there a difference between, in terms of multiples that a roofing company owner would get if they're a retail business versus an insurance-based business? Which is more preferable? Which business model will get you a higher multiple with private equity?
Okay. So yeah, this is a very, this is a controversial topic, right? And like you said, you've heard different people tell you different things. So the answer is actually not that obvious, but it's obvious to us because this is what we do every day. We represent business owners and we sell them on the market. So it doesn't matter is the answer. And then maybe that's a disappointing answer, but it does not matter. Why? Because there are certain investors that sit on this side of the world and they will only buy retail companies. And then there's some that sit on this side of the world that say, we will only buy companies that are doing insurance work. Okay. Well, here's the reality. The reality is, as time goes on and data is being collected on both of these models that originated years ago, what we're finding is that when it comes to valuation and predictable revenue stream is the theme here. I see it. My personal opinion is it's a blend of 50-50. If you could prove to the market that you could service them whether or not there's a storm present or not, and you're selling them on retail, and then if there is a storm that hits and when it hits, and you could still prove to serve them, it really takes out that lumpiness of your revenue. And I find that an equal blend of 50-50 is the balance that most investors, some are realizing this now, and most of the big ones have realized this already. But you know, even as I'm saying these words, this information is getting out to the world. But more and more people, and specifically investors and business owners, are learning that having it as close to an even blend of retail versus insurance work is the best path forward. Some of our clients have 70% retail, 30% insurance, or vice versa. That's still okay because you've at least proven yourself in the market to live on both sides of that payment kind of a process and structure.
That made the most sense to me because someone told me a long time ago that the best kind of roofing companies are the ones that are positioning themselves as storm catchers, right? They can service the market as someone, even if there's no storm, but when there is a storm, they take 100% advantage, right? So that's kind of the key thing, right? That whole aspect.
Yeah, and that, I mean, we don't need to say names. I don't know who told you that, but you know, they're looking at this from a certain optic and lens, and maybe it's just inexperience, right? But the reality is, you know, we, Meritage Partners, our firm, we're contacted a couple dozen times a day by these investors saying, hey, this is the kind of companies we're looking for. These are the industries that we want. These are the geographies that we want. These are the size of companies that we want. We want insurance pay. We want retail pay. We have all that intel and that data. And so when you look at, you know, those that have been mostly successful, I've seen it in my observation because I've seen their books. It's going to be some blend of both retail and insurance pay. And I think that, you know, even through, like I said, this messaging, I think that's going to become more and more common knowledge in the industry. And I suspect that over the next 6 months, more people will be talking like you and I are right now.
Awesome. You said marketing is one of the strongest levers for valuation when it creates measurable and consistent results. Can you explain that connection?
It comes down to predictable nature, right? So if you've created, you know, a system or a process for marketing and ad spend, and the result of that, remember I was using that machine as an illustration, right? If you're pumping in, you know, $10 of advertising into that machine, and you know, $1,000 of work comes out the other end, like you're doing something right. So when you think of it from that standpoint, it has to work whether you exist as the owner or not. Whether you're the owner or I'm the owner of the same company, that system has to be transferable. And that's what investors want. If you figured out something very unique, and maybe that strategy, marketing strategy, doesn't work across the country, but if it works in your state and if it works in your region, and you're the only one that's figured that out, that has a tremendous amount of value to investors. Because they don't only want to replicate what you've done, but they want to own it. Because if they own it, they are ultimately getting a head start from their competition to deploy that strategy in the market.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think when private equity acquires a company, one of the first things they do, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, is they just pump up the marketing because it's kind of a, you know, it's kind of like a lever to growth, right? And a lot of these guys, in my experience, in the construction industry, based on my research, right, this is like real numbers. The typical construction industry, talk about it as a whole, right, because a lot of construction companies are really small, actually. It's 1-2% of top line revenue they're spending on marketing, which is very underdeveloped, right? Now in roofing, it's like 5%, other industries, 6-7%. That's most cases, it's not the 5%. They're not spending the actual 5% of top line revenue on revenue, right? If you look at SBA, right, typical small businesses, their recommendation is 10%. But if you're more aggressive, it's actually maybe 15%, right, of top line revenue on marketing. So there's different numbers. But the point is that a lot of these guys are just not spending a ton of money on marketing. That's just the reality. And it comes down to because of lack of results, but also lack of education and not really just actually just setting aside the money because it's the biggest issue I've seen with construction and roofing space and these other spaces is basically cash flow, right? Like how to actually manage cash flow correctly, because construction, you're getting a delay in payment, right? You get paid typically after the job is done and all that. So there's a delay of payment. So managing that cash flow and understanding how that works. But they're not setting aside money to reinvest in the business. That's the main thing. If they do that and they do it consistently, then they'll be much more successful, but, and being disciplined about it, right? With that being said, like what do you think, what are the metrics you look for, right? If you're evaluating a company and you're looking for, okay, I want to see the CRM, right? What are the metrics you're looking for in terms of marketing and sales that you want to see on the metrics you're seeing?
Yeah, so we're going to look at CAC and LTV, right? Client acquisition costs or customer acquisition costs, and then lifetime value of that customer. Because if you could measure those two things, and when you think about it, that's really, the CAC is your efficiency in terms of earning a client, right? Or acquiring a client or a customer. The lifetime value really comes down to, okay, how many services can you sell them, right? And that's really dependent upon what they need. But here's a more likely scenario that I've seen. And you've talked about the right things, you know. They spend the money, they spend it inefficiently and it doesn't work, or they get enough work, but then they have cash flow issues. So then they don't have the money to spend. And so the revenues get very lumpy because, you know, it goes up and down and up and down. And that's a product of basically not having the appropriate systems in place, right? And so when you look at on the other side of that spectrum, let's think about that. So if you have a company that has an efficient marketing spend, they go out to market and now they're bringing in more leads than they've ever imagined, right? And they're falling on their face because they cannot even show up to all the appointments, let alone convert those appointments to contracts. And then once they get the contracts, can they fulfill and get the job done? And if they don't get the job done, that's one of the reasons why they don't get paid or paid on time, is because there's all of these inefficiencies in the business. So I think that from my optics, at least, and look, I've looked at thousands of companies, and especially in the home services space, is that everyone has good intentions. They spend the marketing dollars, they get results. But what I see mostly is their results were unexpectedly good. And because those results were so good, now they're scrambling on the back end to service all of this. And so then they get discouraged and they say, okay, well, let's back off the marketing spend because we can't handle that much work. But in reality, you need to do this in steps and stages, right? If you just turn on the marketing spend from zero to $10,000 a month, you better be in a position where you can service all of the leads that you're likely going to produce from that campaign. So I think it goes both ways. You know, sometimes there's not enough success, but I think in most circumstances, people have too much success once they do that marketing spend and then they pull back.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously with AI, I want to ask this, how are you looking at the technology stack of a company, right? How do you evaluate that? How does that determine the evaluation? Is that an important factor? Yes or no, or how do you look at that?
So I think of that question in a couple of ways, right? So, you know, your tech stack, is it proprietary technology or is it technology that you've coupled from, you know, 20 different software providers and you created a unique package or tech stack? If you developed your own software and your own technology and it's creating efficiencies in the business that others are struggling with, the results of that is going to be higher profit margins. So the valuation of a company with its own proprietary processes or technology will be valued higher, because so as long as those processes and systems are feeding the business with larger profit margins. If you develop your own technology and it's terrible and it's less efficient and you're less profitable, it's actually working against you, right? And in that situation, you might as well stop being a software developer and just use a tool that's out of the box. But there's also those that they use the out of the box software tools and they use multiple, you know, from AI to CRMs, so on and so forth. But the reality, when you think about all of that, whichever side of the aisle you sit on, the end result has to be It has to be that those systems, like CRMs, AI, AI agents, AI calling agents, and things as such. I mean, you've seen the technology that's out there. It's all good things, so as long as you can convert that to revenue, but not just any revenue. You need to be able to convert that into profitable revenue, and so your margins have to be solid and strong to access a higher valuation.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think the impact of AI is going to be in the home services space, and how that is it going to affect the M&A space?
I think that there's a lot of opinions on this. I think we could all agree that there's going to be some parts of home service businesses that will be done better by AI over time. And there's some parts of the business that AI will just, for the foreseeable future, won't be able to do, right? We're not going to see robots on a roof installing shingles. We're not going to see robots on a roof doing torch down roofs. We're not going to see robots on a roof installing, standing seam, 100-year rated roofs, right? So, but what we will see is appointment setters, AI agents doing appointment confirmations. We'll see tools being used from getting reimbursement from insurance companies and making sure that the insurance companies are getting all the documentation they need to close out a claim and to pay on that claim. We're going to see AI enabling the human to do more work efficiently. But there again, it's not taking over the world as some fear, maybe in our lifetime, maybe not, but at least for the foreseeable future, AI is really there to equip the humans to be more efficient, to be more accurate, and to produce a higher performing company.
I want to ask the CAC question again, because it's a big thing that I'm trying to educate our clients on, at the importance of that. Because for myself, my business, I look at it once a month. I look at what the CAC is, look at the LTV every month. And it's basically, I do it manually. I've been doing it for a while. But how do you think they, because having a big challenge is actually having clean data, right? How is that accurate, right? How do I know if it's accurate? How do I know the lead is coming from this channel or that channel, right? How do they determine what's the most profitable channel? Because you guys, I'm assuming you guys probably look at the CRM and then determine like, hey, this is your CAC. Or typically, do the owners already know what their CAC is before?
Some of them do, some of them don't, and some of them never even heard of that acronym CAC. So it's a mixed bag. But those that understand it are obviously knowledgeable enough to know, how marketing works and what are the measurements that you need and want to take when spending money on marketing. But I think I've read a lot of books over the years. I really enjoyed reading $100 Million Offer by Alex Ramosi. He goes into some great details in and around CAC and LTV. That's where he lives, right? That's where he lives in his market. And I think that is a good, solid starting point for someone that doesn't understand marketing or CAC or LTV. I think that's a great book to pick up and read and to learn about it, because it comes down to education. It starts with that education, because the more we know, right? And think about books as knowledge, but think about knowledge as a tool, right? And we've always heard the phrase growing up, knowledge is power, right? But, I've thought about this phrase over and over again over the years, and knowledge is power, but I believe wisdom is your ability to use that knowledge. Right? Because knowledge can be used for good or bad. Wisdom helps you decide, the difference between good and bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how do you say the future of M&A? Like, these guys are especially in roofing and plumbing, HVAC, they're consolidating, right? I see a lot of bigger players coming in. What do you see the market then happening in the next 5 years?
So the home service market over the next 5 years will continue to consolidate. So you'll see less competitors and competition out there in the market, which means you're going to see larger competitors out there in the market. They're going to be multi-state operators to national operators. And you're going to see insurance companies gravitating towards those companies, because insurance companies don't want to deal with thousands and thousands of contractors across the country for a claim. It's very costly for them. They would rather deal with one or a handful of national contractors that they could go to and they could work with. So I think that we're going to see the same thing we saw in the water and fire damage restoration space. We're going to see in the roofing and siding, windows and door space as well.
So, and water, just to clarify that, so how many businesses did they have? And you say it's dominated by six players. Like how many, from how many businesses to like six players, how many businesses did they consolidate in total?
I could get you the stats, but in water and damage restoration, there were thousands, like nationwide, thousands. And those were consolidated. Now, there are still those smaller players in the market. But the reality is insurance companies are giving favorable treatment to those larger national companies, whether they say it or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. That's cool. It's very interesting. And so you think that's going to happen in home services? Like there's going to be like five players in roofing, five players in plumbing like that.
I think over time, yes. I think in 5 years, you'll see thousands of companies distilled down to hundreds. And then, you know, perhaps over the next 15 to 20 years, you'll see hundreds going to a dozen or a couple dozen nationwide players.
You talked about this before, but obviously, like it's a big emotional impact that some people have when they sell a business. What are the things that they should look out for, I guess? Like, what are the things that they should prepare for?
Well, yeah, the question is, what are you exiting into? That's the question you have to answer. Right? If you want to exit, why? And what are you going to do? Are you exiting the business because you want to go into a different trade or a different industry? Are you exiting the business because you want to partner with a growth capital group that's going to take you to, you know, a 10x level of your company's version today, right? So what are you exiting into? That's the question you should be asking. And we do provide some guidance in my book, The Inevitable Exit, which really helps guide you on understanding what you want and what those expectations should be. Like, for example, if you said, hey, I want to sell my company for $50 million. We could quickly and easily tell you if it's worth that today. And if it's not, we could give you actionable advice on what you could do to improve the valuation to access a $50 million offer.
Awesome. All right, where do people find you?
All right, so a couple tools I want to offer to everyone. Of course, you know, visit us at The Inevitable Exit to get the 10 deal killer list that you should be mindful of. We also generated and developed our own AI tool. It's a valuation and an assessment tool, and that could be found at applebytes.ai. And so we talked about the bites of the apple, right? That's where that name derived from. But applebytes.ai, there's a free version and a paid verified version. Where you could go in and plug in your information and determine and understand what the range of valuation your company is today. And for the paid version, we'll give you actionable advice on how to improve the business to increase the valuation so you're earning the value that you want to achieve on the sale of the business. But other than that, you could find us on social media, LinkedIn, or Meritage Partners is our domain. There you could sign up for future events to learn more about our workshops and masterclasses that we put on. So we look forward to seeing you guys there and just continue to educate and equip you all with the knowledge that you need to be able to trade your privately held company like a publicly traded stock broker.
Yeah. I want you guys to really check out Brian's information. The links will be in the description. A lot of great information you shared. It's free information that you got, really a masterclass that you guys can really find. I really find this information very valuable. My industry, it's digital marketing, but it's very similar. And anybody's a founder should be listening to this, right? Because they should be looking at this in that manner. I really think that, right? I don't think having a business should be a job. It should be something that you should prepare for as something that you should eventually exit and maybe pass on to your family or do something with it, right? Something that you created for your family, right? Thank you, Brian. I really appreciate everything. It was awesome talking to you.
Mauricio, a pleasure to speak with you. And again, honored to be here. Happy to come back anytime. And I'll see you soon.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for listening to AI and Marketing for Home Service Pros. If you got value from today's episode, do us a favor. Follow the show, share it with a contractor friend, and leave a quick review. Want help using AI or smarter marketing to grow your business? Head to contractormarketingpros.net and book your free strategy call.